Okay, good morning, everybody. This is voucher 31231, and it is November 23rd. And I still can talk louder than you guys because I have this little volume knob right here. So I can go louder, 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 louder. Okay, listen up, all you students out there. Do we have a question? So on digestive system. Okay. Thank you. Ah, that's where we are. Okay. We can do that. All right, so digestive system here. So that means we're in the wrong chapter here. And so we're just starting out digestive system. All right, so the slide shows you the alimentary canal, which is the major part of the digestive system. That's the tube that runs inside your body, right? It's open to the outside world at both ends. So whatever in this tube really is not inside your body, it's really outside your body. In order to get stuff that's inside of this tube, the alimentary canal, it has to be absorbed into your circulatory system before it enters your body. All right, so let's look at some parts of this of the alimentary canal. And I probably want to close this down. Bless you, don't need that anymore. Sure, we'll save changes. All right, so the first part of the alimentary canal is the oral cavity. And I suppose the lips you could consider part of the oral cavity. And what did your mom always tell you about your lips? Close your mouth when you're chewing food, right? And I suppose that's really important if you're just a youngster, because if you're chewing on food with your mouth open, right, it's not going to end up in your stomach. It's going to end up on your face, and then you won't thrive, right? So that's important. What's the name of that muscle right there that closes your lips? Orbicularis oris, right? Okay, then you got some teeth. We're not going to spend a lot of time with teeth, but you got some really good figures in your book that show the different kinds of teeth. Some are for cutting, some are for grinding, like the molars are for grinding, incisors for cutting. And before that food can transit from the oral cavity down to the stomach via the esophagus right here, some lubrication has to be added to it from salivary glands, namely saliva. And there are three salivary glands you should be aware of: parotid glands around the temporal mandibular joint, the sublingual gland underneath the tongue, and then the submandibular glands underneath and medial to the mandible. Right, so that just adds saliva. Then you have the esophagus, and that's made up of smooth muscle, so that propels food down into the stomach. And from there, it goes into the small intestine. Small intestine's got three different divisions. The proximal division closest to the stomach is the duodenum. Then the distal division that's closest to the large intestine that I see right here is the ileum. And all the stuff that's in between is the jejunum. And we don't have a really nice line of demarcation between these different parts of the small intestine. It's just that if it's close to the stomach, it's going to be the duodenum. If it's close to the cecum, it's going to be the ileum. And if you can't tell what it's close to, it's going to be the jejunum. Right? So that's how you would tell that. All right, then you have the large intestine right here, ascending, transverse, descending, sigmoid. All right, then the rectum and anal canal. All right, so that is the digestive system. There are some accessory structures that aid in digestion and absorption of nutrients. We talked about teeth. We talked about salivary glands, but there's some other things too, like the liver. The liver is important because it produces a detergent-like molecule called bile, and bile allows oils and lipids to dissolve in water. It's what we call an emulsifier, so that enzymes that are dissolved in water can break lipids down. And I don't know if we talk much about names of enzymes, but sometimes, at least with modern nomenclature, we take the substrate name and put an ASE on the end of the word to define what the enzyme is. So what kind of enzyme will digest a lipid? Would be a lipase. That's right. And so the pancreas, right, which is just underneath the stomach, produces lipases, which then empty into the duodenum via the pancreatic duct, which then can break down lipids if they're emulsified. If they're a huge, big globule, then it can't be digested. Bile comes from the liver. It's stored in the gallbladder when you're in a fasted state, but when you're in a fed state, the gallbladder contracts and pushes bile out into the pancreatic duct, which then empties into the duodenum, the proximal segment of the small intestine. So you have some accessory structures. You see spleen on this diagram, but it's not involved with a digestive tract whatsoever, but it's an important landmark because we see that the large intestine makes a nice 90-degree bend right here, and it's juxtaposed to the spleen, so sometimes we call that the splenic flexure. Flexure is a 90-degree bend in the large intestine, and it's close to the spleen, so it's a splenic flexure. Here is the left colic flexure, right? And it goes around by another name because it's close to another organ. I'm sorry, the right colic flexure because it's close to another organ. What's a large organ on the right side of your body in the superior abdominal cavity? We have the, like the liver, okay? So this is also called the hepatic flexure because a scientific name for liver is, whenever you hear it, would be hepatic or hepato or something like that, would be referring to the liver. Hepatitis is an inflammation or infection of the liver, right? All right, so here is the whole alimentary canal. It's loaded with lymphatic tissue, right, with throughout the whole mucosa of the intestinal tract. But here's a special little organ that's the appendix. It's just a vestigial organ. Most animals have a cecum in this location, which can be even larger than the small intestine in its entirety. But in humans, it's very small. It's not used for absorption or digestion anymore. It contains just lymphatic tissue. What's the job of lymphatic tissue? To fight infection, right? To fight infection. And so that's the job of the appendix right here. So through evolution, it has regressed to just be lymphatic tissue and not used for digestion and absorption anymore. Okay, it can become chronically inflamed, like tonsils can become chronically inflamed. And as a matter of fact, the inflammation can be so bad that it will burst. Hopefully you receive medical attention before that happens, because you'll be really sick if that appendix bursts, but it's typically not a fatal circumstance. You might feel like you're going to die, but chances are you're not going to. But if it becomes chronically inflamed, it should be removed, okay? Just like how we put our ligatures around the umbilical vein in lab, right? You tie it off over here, tie it off over here, and snip in between, and then it's removed, no problem. Okay, another organ that does contain a lot of lymphatic tissue, don't forget about, is the spleen over here as well. All right, so that's not the reason why it's included on this slide, though. All right, so those are all kind of in just some bullet points, the components of the elementary or the digestive system. All right, did I forget anything? Your throat is what we call the pharynx, stomach, small intestine, pancreas, liver, large intestine. That's pretty good. Salivary glands secrete salivary amylase. We know that's an enzyme because of the ASC over here, and it's for the digestion of complex sugars, like starches, for instance. It will break a complex starch, which might have thousands or tens of thousands of units of glucose. It will break it down into disaccharides, two monomers of glucose put together. And we produce about 500 milliliters of saliva every day. So here is a bottle that I have. And how many mLs are in this bottle right here? We should say pretty quickly, I'm having a hard time finding it. It's what, maybe 250 mLs? Something like that. So if you were to walk around, oh, here it says. Oh, no, 591. So this is about how much saliva you produce every day. So if you were to walk around with an empty Coke bottle and just spit into it all day long, you'd fill it up with saliva. Which means what? Your body is losing this much water, and that produces dehydration. All right, and if you're dehydrated, you can't regulate your body temperature. Electrolytes go out of balance, which means the heart will start misbehaving. Muscles won't contract properly. Nerves won't conduct electrical impulses properly. So maintaining good hydration state is important for all kinds of reasons. So saliva is fluid lost from your body. All right, let's look at layers. of the digestive tract. Or some layers. And layers are always important. Always, always, always important. Here are some layers. Okay. So the outermost layer. What's the outermost layer of the eyeball called? Sclera, right? It's connective tissue. Well, here's the outer layer of the elementary canal. It's not called sclera, but it's called serosa. Right? It's part of the peritoneal membrane that forms around the intestines, and the intestines are suspended from this layer right here. And if it's out in this region, we call it mesentery. If it actually forms part of the visceral peritoneum, then we call it the serosa. It just is connective tissue. So here we have the serosa right here with connective tissue and an epithelial lining on the outside. And it secretes a lubricating fluid called serous fluid, so it allows these intestines to squish around inside your body and propel food, digesting food through your intestinal tract. The next deepest layer is the muscularis externa layer. It's in most places of the elementary canal, it's made up of two layers. The most superficial layer, the muscle fibers are arranged on axis, meaning the long dimension along the tube. So we call this the longitudinal layer. And then deep to that is a circular layer of smooth muscle. Right, so here is a circular layer, which is deep to the longitudinal layer. And then I see some yellow structures moving through the layers right here. These are nerves that control how these muscle fibers contract. And they're a plexus, so they're highly interrelated with each other, and they control the propulsion of the digesting material through your digestive tract. We call this the myenteric nerve plexus. And we can see that in the muscularis externa, as well in other layers within the digestive tract. And as a matter of fact, you have more neurons in your digestive tract than you do your spinal cord. And we call that the myenteric nerve system. And for centuries, people thought that our brains actually were part of our digestive tract because there are just so many neurons within the digestive system. But it just controls motility, right, or movement of material in the digestive tract. Okay, and then of course I see arteries and veins, and that's part of your, what part of the circulation is this, pulmonary or systemic? Systemic, yeah, because pulmonary goes where? Yeah. Your lungs. So if you see a red blood vessel in the systemic circulation, you know it's what? An? I gave you a hint. An? Artery. And if it's blue, it's a vein. If it's a pulmonary circulation, what can you tell me? It's opposite, right? So the pulmonary vein is going to be red. Pulmonary artery is going to be blue. That just signifies the state of oxygen. Okay, then deep to the muscularis externa is the submucosa. Submucosa contains a lot of glands that secrete digestive enzymes into the lumen of the small intestine. And it contains blood vessels, and it also contains a lot of lymphatic tissue that fights infection because there's bacteria in the lumen of the blood vessel of the digestive tract right here, especially the large intestine, the large intestine. All right, but this diagram is good for pretty much all the different segments of the elementary canal. All right, then the next layer is the mucosa. And we see the muscularis mucosa. So here is another layer of smooth muscle, which is controlled by the myenteric nerve plexus. And this one down over here is going to be called the submucosal nerve plexus that controls the the muscularis mucosae. And then we have lamina propria in this region right here that controls, that has more glands. And here I see a germinal layer. This is Malthus's mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. So again, this fights infection, for helps prevent bacteria from going from the elementary canal into your body. Okay, and then the next deepest layer is the mucosa. There is a simple cuboidal epithelium, which is the deepest layer that lines the lumen of this tract. And then there's another lamina propria, okay, which is part of the mucosa. So those are the important layers that you should know something about. Okay, a couple of these layers contain that myenteric nerve plexus. Parasympathetic innervation, stimulates digestion, increases motility, and antagonistic to that is the sympathetic. All right, so how would you characterize the sympathetic nervous system once again? Fight or flight, right? So when you're presented with a stressful circumstance, what should your body be ready to do? Okay, your muscles should be receiving a lot of blood, your heart should be receiving a lot of blood, your pupils should be dilated so that you can receive a lot of light. Okay, but digestion during that period of time is not an important function. All right, so that's controlled by the parasympathetic nervous system, which you would characterize as what? Rest and digest, right? So since it's rest and digest, it stimulates the digestive processes in terms of secretions, but also in terms of motility in the large intestine. All right, which takes us to the next point, motility. There are two modes of moving things through the digestive tract. There's something called peristalsis, and then there's something called segmentation. Peristalsis moves material from mouth to the anus, right? Usually just in a simple direction. We call that anterograde propulsion. It means it doesn't go backwards, it just goes forward. So peristalsis, here we have a little slide that shows peristalsis. Here is a bolus of food, and it's moving from mouth to anus. And so circular muscles contract in just a certain way that moves this bolus of food in one direction. All right, and I suppose longitudinal muscles can contract, pulling the tube up in this direction. So if the tube is pulled up toward the mouth and this bolus stays in the same place, it's what? It's actually moving in a direction, right, toward the anus. And actually that's kind of how snakes swallow. Did you ever see a snake swallow anything? They don't really swallow, they just kind of crawl over whatever they're eating and it ends up in their stomach. Okay, the other kind of motility is when you have a bolus of food in one segment of the alimentary canal and then a circular muscle contracts in this region and in this region right here, and it splits this bolus of food into two separate locations, right? So this is not moving the food in one direction, not from mouth to anus, but it's mixing, right? And then it goes back to this condition over here, and then you end up with these compartments all mixed together. We call that segmentation. And one part of the digestive tract that's very important in terms of segmentation or mixing is the stomach. All right, so the stomach is designed to hold a lot of food that we eat until the small intestine is ready to do its job. Let me take a look at this stomach slide right here. All right, so segmentation is both anterograde and retrograde propulsion. It chops, it churns, it mixes stuff up, right? And it fragments digestive materials. So there's a big difference between peristalsis and segmentation. Okay, so the esophagus, there's no segmentation taking place in the esophagus. It's just peristalsis, right, to move things into the stomach. All right, and then things will go into the stomach and then the small intestine. The job of the small intestine is digestion. Digestion is taking large molecules, breaking them down into smaller molecules, and that happens because of enzymes that are secreted from the small intestine itself or the pancreas, and then it absorbs those small molecules. So digestion and absorption are important for the small intestine. That's not the case for the stomach. The job of the stomach is to hold food that we eat and present it to the small intestine in a timely manner, because it takes time for the small intestine to do its job. So if we put a lot of material into the small intestine, it's going to move out of the small intestine and into the large intestine, and you're going to lose the value of all those nutrients. It will move through the small intestine without being processed. So the job of the stomach is to store food until such time that the small intestine is ready to go to work and digest and absorb it. There's some initial digestion that takes place in the stomach. Okay, there is an enzyme called pepsin. It does an initial digestion of proteins, but it's a minimal amount of digestion, not very much. And the stomach also secretes hydrochloric acid, which makes the environment of the stomach very acidic, very close to pH of 1, which is about as low as you can get. That aids in the digestion of proteins via pepsin right here. All right, some other secretions. Our intrinsic factor, which is necessary for the absorption of vitamin B12. And a vitamin is a organic molecule that your body can no longer produce on its own. So, and it's necessary for you to maintain health. So if your body doesn't produce it, human bodies don't produce this particular vitamin, but you need it to remain healthy, then where do you get it from? From your diet, right? From food. So you have to have this in your diet, and it's not readily absorbed. The stomach has to secrete intrinsic factor in order for you to absorb this vitamin. It goes by another name. Sometimes it's called cobalamin. And does anybody know a metal element that's necessary for hemoglobin so that it can absorb oxygen? Yeah, it needs an iron molecule, okay? Cobalamin, on the other hand, doesn't need iron, but it needs a little iron element, and that little, it needs a metal element, and that metal element is cobalt. So it's kind of a strange thing, and of course our bodies can't make iron, can't make cobalt, so, okay, obviously then vitamin B12 is a vitamin. And vitamin B12 is necessary for mitosis. All right, can you remember anything about mitosis? What's mitosis good for? For replacing old and damaged cells, okay, for growth. But there are some tissues in your body that are highly metabolic and they don't live for a very long period of time, including like red blood cells. They only live for about 120 days, so that's a highly metabolic region, highly mitotic region, making red blood cells. So if somebody doesn't have adequate cobalamin or vitamin B12 in their diet, guess what they become? What is that condition called when you run out of red blood cells? Anemia, that's right. Then somebody becomes anemic, okay, because they don't have vitamin B12 in their diet. All right, that's typical of people that are on a liquid diet all the time. And we think of these as, well, I'll just say alcoholics. Okay, that are just drinking all the time, just drinking vodka or whatever. They don't have any this vitamin in their body. And when they come into emergency room, one of the first things they get is a shot of cobalamin, vitamin B12, to boost their red blood cell production back up. Okay, there's a chemical compound called chyme. That's just a mixture of food and gastric juice. All right, and so that's why segmentation is an important function of the stomach, because it mixes hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor and pepsin and water, right, which is what hydrochloric acid is dissolved in, mixes it with food that we eat to make chyme. That's gastric juice. And gastric juice, I thought I had a little figure of merit. How much gastric juice? Yeah, we make 1.5 liters of gastric juice every day. All right, and that fluid leaves our cardiovascular system, further exacerbates or makes dehydration even worse. All right, so how much fluid have we lost from our body already if we just consider secretions in the oral cavity and the stomach? Yeah, so that's 2 liters of fluid already. That's a huge amount of water that your body have lost. Because remember, inside your alimentary canal, that is what? Really, it's a compartment that's outside your body. That's not really inside your body. All right, so the parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. Chief cells, on the other hand, secrete pepsinogen and gastric lipase. What can you tell me about pepsinogen? There's some important nomenclature right here. If you ever see a word with ogen tacked on the end, we call that a suffix, that means that that is a molecule that is inactive. It's not active, but it can be converted into an active form very quickly inside your body when the case arises. All right, so pepsinogen is converted into pepsin as a result of this hydrochloric acid that's secreted from the stomach. Right, it cleaves this molecule and makes an active pepsin molecule. All right, so pepsin is an enzyme that can digest proteins. You have plenty of proteins inside cells. So you might wonder, well, how is the stomach protected from being digested by the things that it's secreting, including hydrochloric acid can dissolve tissues as well. So there has to be a special lining that protects the surface of the stomach. And a part of that simple columnar epithelium are goblet cells. And what do goblet cells secrete? mucus. And mucus is actually a pretty tough kind of molecule. It forms a barrier between the epithelium of the mucosa and gastric juice, which would dissolve the stomach away very shortly. Okay, when people lose the ability to secrete mucus or it's degraded, then they end up with stomach ulcers, for instance, or erosions of the stomach. And if that gastric juice goes up into the esophagus, then esophageal erosions as well. There are enteroendocrine cells. When we say entero, what system should we be thinking of? How about liver? What's the term for liver? Hepato or hepatic? Okay, what about bone? Bone would be osteo. Entero refers to the digestive system. All right, so there are endocrine cells. There's endocrine cells within the intestinal system that secrete signaling compounds that help control digestion and absorption. The stomach secretes gastrin, which, when you eat something, is released, and that goes to the parietal cells and tells them to secrete hydrochloric acid. All right, but when you're in a fasted state, then these enteroendocrine cells should not be secreting gastrin because you don't need to be putting hydrochloric acid into the stomach unless there's food inside the stomach. And if that system goes awry, if it loses control, then hydrochloric acid would be released into the stomach all the time, right, exacerbating ulcer formation. All right, so these control systems are pretty important. All right, but nonetheless, the stomach is in a really rough environment because of all of that hydrochloric acid that's in there. So the cells that line the stomach only live maybe about a week at the most, maybe 7 days, and they have to be replaced. Otherwise, you end up with a big hole in the mucosa. So there are undifferentiated stem cells that renew the gastric epithelium every 3 to 6 days. So that's a highly metabolic region. So you can think of almost getting a whole, not really a whole new stomach. The mucosa doesn't get replaced, but the mucosa layer, the mucosa gets replaced every week. You get a new lining of the stomach every week. Pretty amazing. Anybody remember what I said for how often you get a new skeletal system? Okay, about every 5 years or so. And I read that someplace, and I tried to find it in Google, and I can't find the reference. So I hope that's true, but it's probably true. Okay? I hate to be giving you false information. But that makes sense, right? Bone is a living tissue. It's loaded with blood vessels, right? It's loaded with osteocytes. All right, so let's look at the stomach. Let's take a couple peeks at the stomach. So where is the stomach at? Okay, so here's the stomach. Here's the esophagus coming down from the oral cavity. And the most superior part of the stomach, we call this the fundus or fundic region, right? And basically it just traps gas so that it doesn't exit up through the esophagus and carry gastric juice with it. So here's the fundus region. The place, the area, the region that's closest to where the esophagus attaches to the stomach, we call that the cardiac region or the cardia. And when there's damage to this region right here, maybe excess of hydrochloric acid, right, you get some indigestion, you get some feelings like you're having a heart attack, okay, and commonly what is that called? Heartburn, okay, and then you can take some acids to alleviate some of that painful sensations that you're getting, but cardiac region is down here by the esophagus. The fundic region is the most superior end, and then just below those regions is the body of the stomach, and then after the body of the stomach, we get into the pyloric region, which is right over here. And you notice that when we talked about layers, we saw that there were two muscularis external layers, but in the stomach, because segmentation is so important, there are three layers of smooth muscles. Right, so you got a longitudinal circular layer and then an angulated layer right here that we call the oblique layer that allows for segmentation. If you look at the mucosa, if you look into the lumen of the stomach, you see a lot of ridges right here. And these are going to be really important tomorrow because what's going to happen tomorrow? Yeah, excessive feasting will be taking place tomorrow. And what's the job of the stomach? Is to hold food until the small intestine can actually process that food. So the stomach is going to stretch and get bigger. This is not a transitional epithelium like we see in the urinary bladder, but because of these folds or rugae, the stomach can expand quite a bit, and it can expand all the way down through the urinary bladder than most people before it perforates, okay, or rips open. So I hope nobody rips open their stomach tomorrow. So is Thanksgiving tomorrow? It is. Oh, wow, I got to do a lot of cooking already. Okay. We should cancel class, but we can't. All right, and we'd feel bad because it would be really, class is just too fun to miss, even though we got other things to do. Okay, what else about the stomach? Here's a lesser curvature. There are mesenteries, which is a membrane that holds the stomach in place, part of the visceral peritoneum. Right, so the lesser omentum would be hanging off the lesser curvature, and the greater omentum would be hanging off the greater curvature of the stomach. And sometimes the omentum is also stored for adipose connective tissue. So it's a place for storing a lot of energy in our body. And this region right here, this is a pyloric region. We see the pyloric canal, which helps funnel chyme to the pyloric sphincter, which normally is closed, until the small intestine says, hey, I'm ready for some more chyme, then the pyloric sphincter relaxes, and then chyme is propelled into the duodenum. Now, what's the pH of the chyme that's in the stomach? Yeah, it's very acidic, okay? And pepsin requires that for its activity, but in the small intestine, now the pH shifts from a low pH or acidic pH to an alkaline pH or really high. And so bicarbonate is secreted into the duodenum from the pancreas and from the wall of the small intestine. And so what happens when you add a base to an acid? Yeah, it becomes neutralized, right? So acids and bases neutralize each other. Excessive bases then are added to the small intestine so that it becomes actually an alkaline pH. So the first segment that we see of the small intestine is the duodenum. Right here. Anything else I want to say about the stomach? No. The important function, just bullet points. For sure, digestion is a part of the stomach, but what I want you to realize, it's not a major part. What's the major function of the stomach? Storing food that we're eating and mixing it with gastric juice, right? Okay. And then you should know these other components of the stomach. All right, so that takes us to small intestine. The function of the small intestine now is what we would usually expect for the digestive system, which is digestion and absorption. So there are secretions from intestinal glands that secrete almost 2 liters of intestinal juice every day into the small intestine. All right, so now let's total it up. How many liters are you being dehydrated of so far? Yeah, so that's almost 4 liters of fluid. That's 2 big Coke bottles, plastic Coke bottles, right, in your refrigerator, and you can't afford to really lose that much fluid in your body. So just kind of remember that till later. All right, the small intestine looks like this right here. Okay, so here's small intestine. You can see the 2 layers, the longitudinal circular layers of the muscularis externa. But in the mucosa, there are special folds right here. And sometimes we call these circular folds. Sometimes we call these plicae circularis. What's a pleat? It's like a fold that you have in your clothing, okay? So a fold or a pleat is the same thing. And plicae circularis means what? It's a circular fold within the small intestine, all right? So this is the part of the digestive system that's important for absorption. What do you need to absorb things in your body? You need, surface area. And hopefully we went through this already. How should you be thinking of surface area? As a doorway over there, right? Okay. So there has to be a large doorway for absorption, so or large surface area. But it still has to fit inside your body. So through evolution, what are some evolutionary processes that take a large surface area or doorway and shrink it into a small space? By making it convoluted, right? By making all these twists and turns. And can you see all these twists and turns in here? Okay, and the large ones that you can see with your naked eye are the plicae circularis, but that's not the only thing. That's just the first thing that makes just a simple straight tube really, really long inside your body, right? So you can make the small intestine probably 4 times as long by just flattening out all of the circular folds. But there's something else. It's these villi. These projections, again, are like mini convolutions in the surface of the mucosa that increases surface area for absorption. You can almost see these with your naked eye. If you look at small intestine, which you should maybe do in lab next week, come to open the small intestine, you'll see the surface is not flat and smooth like the spleen, but it will look like a velvety surface. And we can even get out a dissection microscope and look at these villi. Okay, so not only do we have to flatten out all of these circular folds to really understand how long the small intestine is, but you have to flatten out all of these villi, which means then that the small intestine is really, really long. But there's something else. If we look at the mucosa, these columnar cells that make up the villus, okay, so here is a villus right here, and we can see the simple columnar epithelium. What else do you see right here? Aha, what is this right here? Where I have the cursor. That's a goblet cell that secretes mucus onto the apical surface, and that protects the small intestine from autodigestion. Okay? So goblet cell, so there's a lining of mucus right here. All right? But if we look at these columnar cells, as an example over here, the apical surface is not flat and smooth, it's convoluted as well, which increases the surface area for absorption. So in order to make the small intestine really flat, if you want to really measure what the effective length of the small intestine is, first you have to stretch out all of these microvilli, then you have to stretch out all of these villi, and then you have to stretch out all the plicae circularis, right? And then the small intestine becomes extremely long and wouldn't really fit inside our bodies if that were to happen. So when we speak of surface area, you should think of what? Doorway. Okay, so surface area, what was I doing here? Surface area is what? Really a doorway for absorption. Here are the three structures that increase the surface area of the small intestine for absorption. Right, the surface area of the small intestine, if it was just a simple straight tube, like a piece of hose or something, if you were to cut the hose open, lay it flat on a table, and then measure the surface area, it would be 3.5 square feet, right, which is pretty big. So I don't have an example of how straight, what kind of surface area that would be, but it would be, what, 1 foot by 3.5 feet? That's probably a little bit more than the tabletop right there. No, a little bit less than the tabletop. But if you were to flatten everything out, if you were to flatten the plicae circularis, flatten out the villi and all those millions of microvilli that are in the small intestine, the surface area increases to 2,200 square feet, which is huge. Right, that's 240 square meters in terms of everyday life. That's about the floor area of an average two-level house, both the first floor and second floor. That's the doorway for exchange in the small intestine. Okay, but if things get into the small intestine, they have to be absorbed by something. And absorption takes place by these capillaries that are inside of a villus, so sugars and proteins. Other kinds of nutrients get absorbed directly into the circulatory system, but lipids don't. Oily materials get absorbed by this capillary that's right in the center of a villus. That's called a lacteal, and that's part of the lymphatic system. So oils and fatty materials get absorbed by the lymphatic system, and then they're packaged in special ways so that they don't plug up your blood vessels, right? But sugars and proteins get absorbed by the regular blood capillaries. Okay, so in this slide, we can see these pits that contain these enteroendocrine cells and cells that secrete enzymes into the small intestine. And everywhere in the small intestine, we see this mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, which fights infection. Right, so you would see these in the stomach as well. All right, so that's pretty important for the small intestine. So don't forget, what's the function of the small intestine? Digestion and absorption. Right? And the small intestine secretes almost 2 liters of intestinal juice every day into the small intestine. Okay, so here are some glands that secrete things. Brunner's glands, that's in the duodenum, right? Secrete a viscous alkaline mucus. What's this alkaline? What's that good for? That means it's just basic. It's going to neutralize stomach acid so that the small intestine doesn't get digested away. The crypts of Lieberkuhn, also known as intestinal glands. They're found in these intestinal crypts, contain goblet cells that secrete mucus, right? And also hormones, for instance, secretin. And secretin is released by the small intestine when a bolus of chyme is presented to it from the stomach. Secretin goes to the stomach, and guess what it tells the stomach? It tells the stomach, I'm busy. Quit sending me stuff. Okay? And we're going to find out why that's real important. So that makes, secretin makes the stomach quiet until the small intestine can do its job. And also in the crypts of Lieberkuhn, there are enterocytes that secrete intestinal juice with digestive enzymes, like proteases, okay, and lipases and amylases. And secretin also signals the gallbladder and pancreatic ducts to start contracting. When the gallbladder starts contracting, what happens? Then bile moves from the gallbladder into the small intestine, but that only happens when the small intestine has food in it. Right, so that's an important control mechanism. And there are Paneth cells that secrete enzymes that act as bactericides that just control unwanted bacteria in the small intestine. But there are beneficial bacteria, right, that we just call normal microbiota within the small intestine. Sometimes they help produce vitamins, which we need. Okay, so there are beneficial bacteria in our small intestine as well as harmful bacteria. And then there were those nodes, we call those pyre patches, that help fight infection as well. I don't know if I have that? So here's a little pyre patch right here. That's mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. So your body is loaded from head to toe with lymphatic tissue. And what does this lymphatic tissue do? Fights infection, right? So we don't spend a whole lot of time with the lymphatic system, but as I've said before, it's probably one of the most important organ systems in your body, right? So we probably couldn't even live 6 hours without a lymphatic system fighting infection and tumor formation in our body as well. All right, let's kind of skip the pancreas for right now and go to the large intestine. Let's talk about the anatomy of the large intestine first. Anatomy of large intestine. It's kind of noteworthy today because that possibly could be a quiz for you in lab. Okay, so here, what's the last segment of the small intestine called? The ileum. So here's the ileum. It empties into the large intestine, but there is a circular smooth muscle that regulates the flow of material into the large intestine, and we call that the ileocecal valve, right? Named after the ileum and the cecum. The cecum is the proximal division of the large intestine. And then hanging off of the cecum is the appendix. And the appendix in humans is a vestigial organ. It's used for digestion in many animals, especially if they're herbivores. But in humans, it's just loaded with mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, or lymphatic tissue, which then helps fight infection. Okay, and in the large intestine that we see right here, you have trillions of bacteria, aiding in absorption and also making vitamins and other kinds of compounds that your body can no longer make. So you have to have the correct kinds of bacteria in the small intestine, and the mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue knows how to kill and suppress pathogenic bacteria but maintain the normal microbiota within the large intestine. All right, then you've got the ascending colon. Here is the right colic flexure. Transverse colon, descending colon, this little squiggly region is the sigmoid colon. Then you have rectum and anal canal. And the anal canal has got a couple layers of sphincters. There's some smooth muscle and then some skeletal muscle. When there's time for a bowel movement, okay, to eliminate, then the smooth muscle relaxes. That puts pressure on the external anal sphincter right here, which is skeletal muscle. And then you have consciously, right, an impression for voiding the colon right here, right? So that's kind of a subtle signal. A lot of people disrupt that signal over the period of their life, right? They ignore that signal, and guess what happens to them? They become chronically constipated, and chronically constipated people are pretty unhappy, right? So don't ignore those urges, okay? There are some agents, naturopathic agents, that might aid in that, but sometimes they just mess your system up more than that they help. So it's important to listen to your natural urges. Okay, so what's the job of the stomach? Let's just kind of review. Job of the stomach is for mixing and storing food. Job of the small intestine, absorption and digestion, or you could say digestion and then absorption. Okay, so absorption is real important. And the job of the large intestine is what? Absorption of water. Now, water we don't really consider a nutrient. It's not an energy source for us, but the large intestine also absorbs salts. Okay, so that when material moves out of the ileum into the large intestine, there should not be any nutrients in that material. Because if there are, what's going to take advantage of all those nutrients? Not necessarily you, but all those trillions of bacteria. They're going to have really big happy smiles on their faces, and they're going to proliferate. So instead of having 1 trillion, you might have 10 trillion or 50 trillion bacteria, right? And that irritates the large intestine, right? So it increases motility. And what that produces then is copious amounts of watery stool instead of nicely formed stool. So the job of the large intestine really is to absorb water, and when that happens, that produces feces. So the short form answer would be the large intestine produces feces by what action? By absorbing water from the processes of digestion. And is that important? Yeah, because how much water did you put into your digestive tract? Salivary glands, stomach, small intestine. What was that? Almost like 4 liters. So the job of the large intestine is very important. If it wasn't to absorb that water, you would dehydrate, probably within just a matter of minutes. Right? And as a matter of fact, probably most people die of dehydration than any other reason out there. So how do people die of dehydration? Because they drink contaminated water, water that's not safe to drink. It's loaded with bacteria. They get into the large intestine right here and produce diarrhea, copious amounts of watery diarrhea. And if water is coming out the anal canal, it's not being absorbed, resorbed back into your body, and you die of dehydration. So who's most susceptible to that? Infants in particular, okay? And fortunately, that's not a major problem in the United States, but it is in most places in the world that don't have safe drinking water. So that's pretty interesting, because if you want to save more lives than anybody else, what's a very simple thing you can do for everybody in the world? Just provide safe drinking water for them. Okay, it's amazing that it's still a huge problem, but that is a huge problem everywhere in the world. Okay, so let's say something else. There was a drug that helped people lose weight, right? So if you're interested in losing weight, one way to do that is to restrict calories, but restrict calories from one particular kind of food. And there's proteins, there are sugars, and there are lipids, right? Of those three foods, if you want to lose weight, what's the best one to restrict? Lipids, right? Because they have over twice the energy content as proteins or sugars. So if you just cut back on lipids, you're really depriving your body of a lot of energy. So somebody had a really good idea of making a pharmaceutical agent that would block the absorption of lipids. So you could eat a lot of lipids, but it wouldn't be absorbed into your body, right? And you would lose weight as a result of that. And that was called Xenical. Okay? And where do you normally absorb lipids at? Small intestine right here. But if the small intestines don't absorb it, where does it go? Goes into the large intestine. All right? And who's there ready to party? All those bacteria, right? So they start proliferating like crazy, and it produces malabsorption syndrome. And what does that produce? Copious amounts of watery stool. Okay? But not just that, but oily watery stool. And the large intestine is so irritated, people on that agent couldn't even tell when they were going to the bathroom, okay, defecating, right down the 405 freeway, or giving a lecture, or taking notes, or a practicum, or whatever. So in that case, what do you have to wear? A diaper, okay? So what about that pharmaceutical agent? Do you think it had a very long life? No, people got tired of it, okay? But recently, All right, somebody had another bright idea and said, well, the dose that we gave was way too high. So people were stooling themselves, losing weight, but stooling themselves. Let's cut back on the dose. All right, and so they remarketed it at a lower dose, and now it's called Ally. Okay, so Ally blocks absorption of lipids in the small intestine. But when you block absorption of nutrients in the small intestine, where do they go? Large intestine, and what does that produce? Like irritable bowel syndrome or malabsorption syndrome is a better way of thinking of it, right, which produces diarrhea. So a lot of times on medication bottles or various kinds of medications, it doesn't just have to be Xenical or Ally. They might block, some medications might block the absorption of nutrients in the small intestine. They go into the large intestine, and then one of the warnings on medications is that it produces diarrhea. So how, when you have a medication that produces diarrhea, how is it usually, what's the mechanism, how does it usually, what's usually happening inside your body when something produces diarrhea? It produces a malabsorption syndrome because it blocks the absorption of some nutrient. It could be a sugar or it could be some other kind of protein that goes into the large intestine that causes that irritation and proliferation of bacteria. Okay? So a lot of medications can do that. All right. There's another problem with the large intestine that could be, you could think of it similar to the prostate, similar to the breast, okay, similar to skin if you have high sun exposure, which is colon cancer. Yeah, in the United States, somebody should Google really fast what the mortality of just in the United States, but I think it's like 50,000 people die of colon cancer. And that's a real shame because colon cancer can be detected very early. And if it's detected early, then it's 100% curable. So it's really a shame that tens of thousands of people are dying of colon cancer when it's so easily detected and so easily cured, right? So if you want cancer, what kind do you want? The kind that can be cured, right? Just by some surgical procedure, just by removing it from its site before it metastasizes. So how do you protect yourself from colon cancer? Okay, a couple, you can't? Exams, yes. Rectal exams, okay? And exams of the large intestine. If you look at just the sigmoid colon, it's called a sigmoidoscopy. If there is an endoscope that's much, much longer, it goes all the way up, probably past the left colic flexure into the transverse colon right here, we call that a colonoscopy. So, which is a better exam? A colonoscopy that looks at the whole colon or just a sigmoidoscopy that just kind of looks at this last distal segment of the colon? Yeah, a whole colonoscopy. Because the difficult part of an exam, right, is if somebody's looking around in here, there can't be any feces inside the colon. So you have to cleanse yourself with a substance which is really... they named it in a really cruel way, okay? They call it Go Lightly, okay? But if you drink a gallon of Go Lightly, that's the last thing that will come to your mind, right? You will go heavily, right? You will flush out all that feces from the large intestine. But is that important to do? It's kind of disgusting. That first couple of sips probably taste okay, but after that, right, you have to drink like 99% of a gallon of this fluid. Tastes really bad. All right, but it's important because otherwise a physician or a technologist can't look around inside the large intestine. So if you drink like 3/4 of a gallon and you still have feces in the small intestine, guess what they're going to tell you? Go home and we're going to have to repeat the exam. So now instead of drinking 1 gallon, you have to drink a gallon again plus whatever you drank the first time. So preparation is really important. So if you ever get a colonoscopy scheduled or a sigmoidoscopy, do exactly what the physician tells you to do. He likes a preparation just a certain way so that he or she can look around in the large intestine. And why is that important? Because it can save your life, right? Because it can detect colon cancer. So if you have any history of cancer, and especially colon cancer in your family, then probably by age 40, you need a colonoscopy. And then if there are precancerous tumors in the large intestine, then probably every 2 years you need to be examined. All right, so these procedures are being adjusted all the time, but that's from my best recollection. So a colonoscopy certainly can save a lot of people's lives. And for people that die of colon cancer, not all of them. Sometimes it's easy to miss colon cancer, even with colonoscopies, and right, even if you're educated, you still can end up with colon cancer that is lethal. But in most cases, right, with that testing regime, you can save a lot of lives. All right, so that's some interesting things about the large intestine with malabsorption syndrome and colonoscopies. And the other thing, anesthetics have been in the news lately. What anesthetic has been in the news lately? Yeah, propofol. Okay, and there's another propofol typically is not used for a colonoscopy. A lot of places don't use any anesthesia whatsoever, right? And in the large intestine, you have smooth muscles, and whenever you stretch a smooth muscle, it has a tendency to contract, right? So it's going to resist that stretching. So anytime anybody's fooling around in the large intestine right here, it's going to produce cramps of the smooth muscle, which are really uncomfortable. It produces a lot of pain. Probably not like childbirth, but maybe close, depending on how they're doing, okay, messing around in here. So anesthesia is probably something that you should have. And like propofol, the anesthetic is very fast-acting, all right? So they'll give you, they'll set up an IV for you, and they'll tell you, count down from 10. So you go 10, 9, and then all of a sudden you feel somebody shaking your head, okay, and they'll say, okay, exam's over. And you go, wow, I didn't even count down to 10 yet, because it's a really fast-acting anesthetic, and it doesn't produce many lingering effects, but you still can't drive home, right? You still need a ride home. And it might come to me what that anesthetic is called. So that just kind of underscores when you get into physiology, if something starts really fast, if the onset of action is fast, the duration is going to be short. So fast-acting, like barbiturates, will have an effect right away, but very short-acting. Same thing for propofol and this other drug that I can't remember right here. If something will take slow to take effect, that means its duration of action will be a long time. Okay, so that's just kind of a, in terms of endocrine system and nervous system and pharmacology, that's just kind of a rule that's obeyed all the time. All right, so that's the large intestine. Okay, so remember, you've got to resorb like 4 liters of fluid from the large intestine so you don't dehydrate. And then, of course, those salts are important because those are electrolytes. All right, that's how GoLightly is actually named. It's not lightly like L-I-G-H-T, it's L-Y-T-E. They're electrolytes because they're important for maintaining all electrical activity inside your body, like nerve conduction and muscle contraction, including your heart. Okay, so no digestion, right, takes place in the large intestine. All that should be taken care of before that material gets to the large intestine. The liver function. Right, it produces bile, and then you know your bile duct system. That was on a quiz this week. When you're in a fasted state, bile goes into the gallbladder. When you're in a fed state, then the gallbladder contracts and squirts bile into the small intestine. It helps neutralize stomach acid, but it also emulsifies fats for digestion and absorption of fats because they're nonpolar compounds. You should know that oils don't dissolve in water. Water is what we call a polar compound, just some electrical properties of these compounds that you'll have to learn something about when you get into a physiology class. All right, so make sure you know your bile duct system. I'm not going to go over that. The liver stores glycogen. And what can you tell me about glycogen? Anybody know anything about glycogen? What the heck is glycogen? We talked about basic food groups, protein, sugars, and fats. What kind is glycogen? It's a sugar. Glycogen is pretty much the same thing as starch. Starch is what we find in plants. Glycogen is what we find in animals. It just depends on the branching nature of those molecules. The basic building block is glucose. Glucose is a sugar. That's why glycogen really is a sugar. And so you can store immense amounts of sugar in your liver. And when might you need a lot of sugar? When you're exercising, yeah, glycogen. Actually, some athletes deplete their body of glycogen when they're exercising. extremely like, can you think of a period of time, what kind of athlete would use up all the glycogen in their body? Like marathoners, right? Like, who were you saying? Oh, bicycle, yeah, cyclists that are doing these long distance rides, things like that, okay? So if you want to build up extra glycogen in your body the night before, what might make sense for you to eat? Like pasta, because pasta is starch, which is basically just glucose. Okay. So another circumstance, every day that you need glycogen in your liver is when you're fasting, like all night long, because blood glucose levels have to be maintained within a normal range. And when you're in a fasted state like all night long, then the liver breaks down glycogen and puts some sugar in your blood so that glucose stays at the same concentration. The liver can also store various kinds of vitamins like A, D, E, and K. These are fat-soluble vitamins, so your body can store them. And because your body can store these vitamins, these can become toxic. You can overdose on some vitamins. Other vitamins you can't overdose on, for instance, like vitamin C, because they are water soluble, so every time you urinate, you will lose vitamin C. So it's impossible to overdose on vitamin C, but not so for these fat-soluble vitamins. It also stores copper and iron. Okay, iron is important for hemoglobin. And the liver is also important because it can interconvert various biochemicals in your body, like vitamin D precursor into an active form of vitamin D. And does anybody know what vitamin D is for? I think we talked about it. It's necessary for absorbing calcium from the digestive tract. So you might have proper calcium in your diet, but you can't absorb it, right, without vitamin D. And what's calcium good for? Yeah, bones is one thing. That's what they always tell you, right? Okay, but synaptic transmission, muscle contraction, right? So even the contractile properties of your heart. So calcium is real important for all kinds of things. It also acts as a certain messenger within cells, controlling metabolism inside cells. Liver can convert fats to phospholipids. What good is a phospholipid? What's it a basic building block of? All cell membranes, right. And then there are even hormones, signaling molecules that are made from phospholipids in cell membranes to control various processes in your body. It can convert amino acids, which is a building block of a protein, into sugars, right? And then the sugar can become a building block of glycogen. And it can convert protein and sugar into fat. And fat is just a storage form of energy inside your body. Proteins, when they're degraded, produce ammonia, which is highly toxic. We can't excrete it from our body very easily, right? And the liver converts ammonia to urea, and urea is a nitrogen compound that can be handled by the kidneys very efficiently to get that toxic compound out of your body, okay? And then the liver is also important because it produces clotting factors that help in coagulation, helps prevent blood loss when a blood vessel gets damaged. And the liver also produces albumins, which is a protein molecule, which helps regulate blood volume, and it prevents you from swelling up. It helps prevent edema. So when somebody has liver damage, might be due to maybe some chemotherapy that you're taking, or maybe chemotherapy that you're taking. No, I said that already. Liver damage due to chemotherapy. Hepatitis, viral infection. Okay. Drinking is really bad on the liver. Unfortunately, I've probably known people to die of liver failure just because they would drink 4 beers a day. 4 beers every single day probably will kill your liver in most people. Don't even need to drink a 6-pack. Because alcohol is not a protein, not a lipid, not a sugar, but it gets converted to fat immediately in your body. Unless you are exercising at the same time, most people don't exercise and drink adult beverage at exactly the same time. Okay? That might be fun under certain circumstances, but typically not. So that alcohol gets converted to fat, and that's stored in the liver, and that produces liver cirrhosis. And liver cirrhosis means then you don't have a functioning liver, and it also means that it can turn cancerous very easily when you have liver cirrhosis. Okay, and that's all due to just drinking excessive amounts of alcohol. Okay, what else? Do we Oh, okay. I guess I can let you out early today because we're done with lecture. So try to remember the functions of each. Oh, no, I got one last thing. One last thing regarding this organ right here. Okay, regarding this organ here, which is right here. All right, what's the function of this organ once again? Absorption of water and salts. Okay, and I think of the large intestine as being an appliance that you have in your home. So by analogy, I want you to think of all the appliances that you have at home, right? And which one can be used as an analogy to describe the job of the large intestine. So could you think of like a toaster? Actually, I heard it already. Okay, a washing machine. Because what does a washing machine do to get your clothes clean? It dumps in a lot of water. Okay, how much water is dumped into your digestive tract? 4 liters, right? You got to put soap into your washing machine. What's soap in your digestive tract? Bile, okay? Mixes it all together, and then what do you end up with? You end up with a bunch of, like, soaking wet clothes. You have to, like, pull them out because they're so heavy they're wet. No, you go through a spin cycle, then all that water is resorbed once again. So I think of a washing machine and small and large intestines being, like, the same thing. Okay, so that's another way of thinking about it. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. We had a formal one today with your name on it. So, and the quiz for lab for next week, I didn't look yet. You just have to check your emails. Okay? All right, so that indeed, that is the end of lecture today, so I'm only letting you out about a minute early. Hey, yeah, happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Let me know if you run into any interesting cases of malabsorption syndrome. Okay, who's got that sign-in sheet? It's probably somebody in the back row over there. Okay. Okay, ladies in the back row, bring the sign-in sheet down. Don't talk to any boys back there.